Let's now go on to the nervous system, which we won't make it all the way through, but we'll get through some of this. It's a brand new organ system, so let's talk about functions. Well, the nervous system is a control system, right? There's how many control systems in the body?
Two.
Two out of how many total organ systems?
11,
right. And the two control systems are nervous and endocrine. They're called control systems, obviously, because they control the other 9 organ systems. So they are involved in maintaining homeostasis in a lot of ways, right? Not only do they control the other 9 organ systems, but the control is even more exquisite because each of the two control systems also controls the other control system. Nervous system and endocrine system interact with each other as well. A fundamental difference between the two, well, a fundamental similarity first between the two, since they're both control systems, they both operate via signals, right? That's how they're able to control the other organ systems. They use signals to do that. But a fundamental difference is in the nature of those signals. So the endocrine system, which we'll get to eventually, operates via chemical signals. That's the only signals it uses are... Now, there's different chemical signals, but they're all chemical signals, which means molecules. What do we... In the case of the endocrine system, what do we call those chemical signals?
Hormones.
Hormones, right. For the nervous system, there's two categories of signals that are used. They use chemical signals also, but they also use electrochemical signals. Now, we've talked already about electrochemical signals. What are those electrochemical signals that they use called? No, those are the chemical signals. What are the electrochemical signals? Electrochemical signals are called that because they are changes in voltage. So the electro part of that word refers to charge. And it's electrochemical because what's carrying those charge are particles, chemicals, ions, basically. So what am I referring to? What are the chemical signals that the nervous system uses? They are action potentials. Right? We've been talking about action potentials already when we got into the weeds a little bit about how the muscles work, right, the last couple times. What do we call, histologically speaking, not forget about organ systems, just think about tissues. There's how many tissues overall?
Four.
But only two of them are able to produce and transmit action potentials. What do we call those for that reason? What's the word that we use for a tissue that's able to create action potentials? We say that they are excitable tissues. Only two of the four tissues are excitable. So what are they?
Nervous
tissue and muscle tissue. That's why we've already been talking about action potentials, because muscles operate via electrochemical signals as well. So nerves, neurons, as far as cells are concerned, they're neurons, conduct action potentials, which are the electrochemical signals. But endocrine system doesn't, so that's a difference. Nervous system, though, also uses its own chemical signals, and you correctly said that those chemical signals that the nervous system uses are not hormones, they're called neurotransmitters. And it's not just a different thing to call them because it's in an organ system. There's actually... a functional difference. There's not necessarily any chemical difference at all. What I mean is that the same exact chemical can be a hormone if it's released by the endocrine system And it can be a neurotransmitter if it's released by the nervous system, even though it's exactly the same chemical. So it's a functional difference how they operate rather than what they are. And what the difference is that hormones from the endocrine system are broadcast throughout the body because they get put into the bloodstream and the blood goes everywhere. On the other hand, the nervous system releases its chemical signals, which are the neurotransmitters, from the ends of axons, right? Those axon terminals we were talking about. And they just stay right there. They only affect the things that are right there where the end of the axon is. They don't get put into the bloodstream. So they act locally rather than globally. But when it comes to acting, meaning having an effect, what did I say is true of signals in general? What has to be true for any chemical signal to have any effect at all?
It must have the appropriate receptors.
Right. It isn't going to have any effect at all unless the chemical signal binds to a receptor that has the right shape for that particular chemical to bind to. And what kind of things are the receptors? What are they made out of?
Proteins.
They are proteins, right. So, at the end of an axon, the neurotransmitters are released, and just that next cell, whatever it is, it could be another neuron or it could be a muscle, will have the right receptors for that particular signal, and it won't go anywhere else. It's local operation. That's a difference between the two control systems. So, in terms of the overall major functions of the nervous system, we see the three major functions in this schematic, in the first slide: sensory input, integration, and motor output. And I mention them in that order because that's the order in which they occur. Sensory input refers to information coming into the nervous system, and specifically toward the part of the nervous system called the central nervous system. So the nervous system as an entire system has a hierarchical breakdown. It has subdivisions. We call the entire system the nervous system. But there are two major parts to it, which are the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. The central nervous system anatomically is just the brain and the spinal cord. And then everything else that's still in the nervous system is the peripheral nervous system, right? So this sensory input that I described as information coming toward the central nervous system, that's coming in through neurons, sensory neurons, via action potentials. So action potentials are sending the information toward the brain or spinal cord, central nervous system. Once it reaches the central nervous system, there is high-level processing of that information. So think about this in terms of homeostasis as we've already discussed it. Whenever we're talking about homeostasis, you're talking about controlling some sort of variable, right? Whatever the variable is, there is a set point, right? Some desired value of that variable, which you might not actually be at the moment, right? The variable has a current value, but it might be different from the desired value or the set point. Well, the nervous system is in charge of controlling whether or not, it's in charge of homeostasis to control these variables, but you can't control a variable unless you know what the current conditions are. You have to be reading the values of those variables all the time, right? And that's a lot of what sensory input is. So the set point really is housed or held in the central nervous system as a comparative value, but it has to be continuously reading what the current value is for any of these variables in order to make that comparison. Now, another thing I should mention again, I think I said this before in one of the lectures, is that there is a difference between sense and sensation. Sense, or sensory input, simply refers to any information that is coming in toward the central nervous system. But that doesn't at all mean that you're aware of it. There's all kinds of sensory input that thankfully you're not aware of. It would be a really distracting life if you were aware of all the sensory information, right? You don't feel your blood pressure or your heart rate or all kind or your body temperature, or your pH. All of these things are continuously being measured because you have to homeostatically control them. Because if they get out of range too far, you're going to die. But that's not sensation. That's just sensory input. Information for the central nervous system to deal with. Sensation, if it does happen, is very high level processing of some of that sensory information to produce an event in the brain. That event is the sensation. And that is something that you become aware of. For instance, you see in your brain after the sensory input comes in, starts at your eyes from the light striking your retinas, and it's sent through optic nerves to your brain. That's not actually seeing. Seeing is what happens in the brain when it receives that information. It makes you realize that something is there. It produces the image in your brain. And similarly, you know, if you get kicked in the shin, it feels like that's happening at your shin. Mm-hmm. But where you feel it is in your brain, where you feel everything. Orgasm, anything's happening in your brain. Similarly with all the senses. So sensation is that. It's high-level processing. It's an example of integration. And that occurs in the central nervous system. But not even all integration by any means are you aware of. There's all kinds of high-level processing or integration that's occurring behind the scenes, which is why you don't have to remember to beat your heart or to move things through your digestive system. That's all behind-the-scenes calculations that's being made. That's what integration is. And then you have motor output. So once that integration is complete in the central nervous system, well, the whole reason it's been doing that integration is to determine what the appropriate change would be that would have to be made in order to maintain homeostasis, more or less. So we call that motor output. Motor meaning something is moving. Now, that's a good descriptor of output that goes to skeletal muscles because that moves us around, right? And that is definitely a part of motor output. But don't let the word motor fool you. It's not only to skeletal muscles, which move our skeleton around. Remember, first of all, that there are three kinds of muscle tissue. So motor output can lead to any of the three muscle types. Nerves are connected to the heart as well, so cardiac muscle is a target of motor output, and so is smooth muscle. Your digestion, the motility through your gut can increase or decrease because of nervous output. And it's more than just muscles as well, even though we use the word motor in all cases of output. It could be any of the three muscles, or it could be glands as well. And glands actually do move, right? When they get stimulated by a neuron to release their whatever they create to secrete, they actually move as well. But that's all output rather than input, because that's information that's coming from the central nervous system after it's done that integration, and it's telling the appropriate target to respond. Okay. Those are the major functions. Let's go on to slide 2 and look at this hierarchical arrangement of the nervous system I was talking about a little bit ago. You have the overall nervous system, but the two parts of it are the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord, and everything else, which is the peripheral nervous system. That everything else anatomically includes cranial nerves and spinal nerves. Nerves are basically bundles of neurons. They're like cables. Okay, we've talked about neurons. A neuron is an individual cell. A nerve and a neuron are not the same thing. A nerve is a cable of many, many neurons, each of which can individually work. Kind of like a large bundle of optical fibers that you use for telephones, for instance, and any one of them can individually send a signal. It's just a bundle collecting them all. Okay, well, the subdivisions don't stop there. The central nervous system doesn't subdivide again, other than saying brain and spinal cord, just the two pieces of anatomy within it. The peripheral nervous system, on the other hand, is then further subdivided into two divisions called the sensory and the motor division, corresponding to the two functions I was just talking about. So the sensory nerves send sensory information toward the central nervous system. And another word for incoming or sensory information is afferent. Afferent means going toward. Then there's the motor division, which there are motor neurons in nerves that carry information away from the central nervous system toward the target tissues. And another word for outgoing information, meaning away from, is efferent. Sorry. You have afferent and efferent. Afferent is incoming, sensory. Efferent is outgoing, motor. Now, the motor division, which is already a subdivision of a subdivision, that motor division is itself subdivided into somatic and autonomic divisions. Somatic is a word, remember I said soma means body? Maybe I said that, I don't know. But somatic means of the body, which is kind of a misnomer because everything is of the body, of course. But here, body really refers mostly to the bulk of the body, which is the skeletal muscles. So the somatic division of the motor division controls only the skeletal muscles and all the skeletal muscles. So you're using that subdivision whenever you move your body in different ways or walk around. On the other hand, the autonomic division, the other subdivision of the motor division, controls all the behind-the-scenes things, things you don't have to worry about or think about. Somatic is under voluntary control. Autonomic is involuntary. You don't choose to beat your heart or anything like that. That's all behind-the-scenes work. But it's still, notice, motor information, right? It's sending information to what are called effector organs, target tissues, to do things. So that is the other kinds of muscle, the involuntary muscles, cardiac and smooth, plus the glands that I was talking about. That's all controlled by the autonomic division. And autonomic is just the adjective of autonomy, which means self-rule, right? Well, it doesn't even stop there. You have the peripheral nervous system, which is a subdivision of the nervous system. A subdivision of the peripheral nervous system is the motor division. Subdivision of the motor division is the autonomic nervous system, as it's called. And then a subdivision, the two subdivisions of that are the parasympathetic and sympathetic divisions, which in essence, functionally, are opposites of each other, meaning they antagonize each other, they do opposite things. So one will increase the activity of a target tissue, the other one will decrease it. And I intentionally just say one will and the other will rather than giving names because it depends on the actual target tissues as to which one will increase and which one will decrease. So it's not always that parasympathetic decreases and sympathetic increases, for instance. It just depends on where you're at in the body. But they work against each other. So it's that really it makes for really good control because you have basically a dimmer switch that you can twist in either direction, right? Parasympathetic or sympathetic gives you really fine control of these involuntary muscles and glands. All right, that brings us to three, where we're going to talk about neuroglia. Now, neuroglia are cells, but so are neurons. So there are all kinds of cells making up the nervous system, but those many different kinds of cells are categorized into one of two categories. because there's a fundamental difference between them. And those are neurons. That's one category by itself. We've talked about those a little bit already. And then all the other cells collectively are called neuroglia. So there's no cell called neuroglia. That's a category of cells. There are different kinds of neuroglia, and we'll look at them in pictures here. But let me explain why those are the two categories, why those are fundamentally different from each other. A few minutes ago, I said that muscle tissue and nervous tissue are excitable tissues, right? Because they are the ones that are able to create action potentials. Well, neurons are in their own category because of the cells in the nervous system, only the neurons are excitable. So they're the ones that are in charge of these electrochemical signals, and the chemical signals for that matter, because neurotransmitters are also released from neurons. So they are really the business end of the nervous system in a sense. They're the ones doing the actual controlling. But they can't do it just by themselves. They won't live if that's the only kind of nervous cells you have. And therefore, you have these non-excitable cells of different varieties that are collectively called neuroglia because they, in one way or another, support the neurons and keep them working, even though the neuroglia do not do that by making their own action potentials or creating their own neurotransmitters. Right? They just help the neurons. Now, there's different categories of these neuroglia that we're going to look at in pictures. The first few are only in the central nervous system, so brain or spinal cord. And the first one shown here, as you see by the label, is an astrocyte. Now, the yellow one is a neuron. That's an excitable tissue, an excitable cell. The astrocyte, notice, is involved with that neuron. But why is it called an astrocyte? First of all, what does the astro mean? Cyte means cell, as you already should know. But what does astro mean? Star, right. Astral or astro mean of a star. It's just called that because it has all these things jutting out from it. Makes it look like an asterisk, which is another word that uses that same root. Now, astrocytes have very elaborate plasma membranes because of all these cell processes, these things sticking out from them. And they wrap around capillaries, notice. Capillaries are small blood vessels. You don't see this in most parts of the body. The capillaries would just be bare. But in the brain and spinal cord, you have them, the blood vessels covered by these astrocytes because there is such a thing in the body as what's called the blood-brain barrier. You might have heard of this. The central nervous system is really important. Probably the most vital organs, or definitely the most vital organs. And so it needs to be very well protected, meaning that you can't let just anything leak out of the bloodstream onto the brain or spinal cord. Therefore, there is a blood-brain barrier that makes sure only certain things that should get through can get through. Now, there are drugs that can get past it, and that's why those drugs are so not only effective, but they can be so habit-forming as well, because they can get right through that blood-brain barrier. But most things can't. And the blood-brain barrier is maintained by these astrocytes. In four, we have microglial cells. This is also a neuroglial cell of only the central nervous system. You don't find them out in the peripheral. It's a much smaller cell than most of the neuroglial cells, and that's why it's called microglial. Micro means small. All the neuroglial cells can also just be called glial cells. That's just another name for them. So microglial means small version of them. And they act as phagocytes. A phagocyte is a cell that specializes in phagocytosis. We've already talked about that, right? What does the word phagocytosis actually literally mean?
Cell eating.
Because a phagocyte will engulf something in its surroundings, take it into itself and destroy it. So these are important for the neurons because they're surveilling the central nervous system all the time, looking for things that shouldn't be there, and then engulfing them to take them out so that they can't be harmed, or they can't harm the neurons. Then we have 5 ependymal cells. And these are found in only one place in the central nervous system. They line the interior surfaces of hollow parts of the central nervous system. There are hollow parts in the brain that we call ventricles. And those ventricles are actually all interconnected. And they then also are continuous with one hollow tube, basically, that goes down the deep part, the middle of the spinal cord. All of that, I say it's hollow, that doesn't mean there's nothing in it. It just means it's not nervous tissue. It's hollow in that respect. But it's filled with fluid that we call cerebrospinal fluid because it's both in the brain and the spinal column. Spinal cord, I should say. That cerebrospinal fluid, the existence of these spaces is really important because it allows for shock absorption. If you didn't have these, your brain would be much more vulnerable to injury like that happens in a concussion. It happens anyway in a concussion. It would be much worse without these hollow parts that are filled with fluid. Well, the fluid gets produced and secreted by the ependymal cells. And the ependymal cells line the entire inner surfaces. So they're between the cerebrospinal fluid and the actual nervous tissue. All right, then we get to 6, which is an oligodendrocyte. It's also only in the central nervous system. Now, it's a site means cell as usual, so it is a cell, obviously. We're looking at one cell here, by the way. This is an elaborately shaped cell. But notice it has one cell body where the nucleus is, as you would expect it to have just one nucleus. Most cells do. But all of this other blue material is part of this same cell. And it's actually much bigger than it looks here, because if you notice this rolling, if you unrolled this, it would be very flat and have a lot of area. But that flatness of its plasma membrane, which is very elaborate and flattened out, allows it to wrap around neurons, the axons of neurons, which are the yellow things. A lot like roll of toilet paper, right? The yellow axon of the neuron is like the cardboard core of the paper roll. But the blue here is like the toilet paper itself. It wraps around several times. That's what oligodendrocytes do. They form what are called myelin sheaths around the axons of neurons in the central nervous system. So some neurons are myelinated, some are not myelinated. The ones that are myelinated are wrapped by these oligodendrocytes. By the way, the myelin, which is the stuff that the sheath is made of, makes it look white. And that's why when we talk about white matter versus gray matter in the brain, you might have heard these phrases. White matter is made up of axons that are myelinated and therefore appear white, whereas gray matter is made up of unmyelinated material. Okay, now why myelinate? Well, that's an insulation. But more than just an insulation, what it allows for is a much faster speed of propagation of the action potentials. Propagation is the chain reaction where one action potential will create another one right beside it, so it goes all the way down the length of the axon to get wherever it's going. With myelination, that occurs a hell of a lot faster. So myelinated axons get their message to the target tissue much quicker than unmyelinated ones do. Now, why is it called this oligodendrocyte? Well, dendro means tree. Trees are branches, are branched structures, right? And this has several branches, so it's kind of tree-like. That's that part of the name. What about oligo? What does that mean? Didn't we use oligo before? I thought we did. Maybe not. What is a monarch or a monarchy? A monarchy is ruled by one person, right? The monarch. That's mono means one. Oligo is between mono, which means one, and poly, which means many. So an oligarchy is ruled by multiple but not many people. Okay? And similarly, when you what's another name for a protein?
Amino acid.
No, those are the building blocks that you use. You have to put many of them together, though, and you form a polypeptide. That's another name for a protein. Well, if you only string together a few amino acids, that's called an oligopeptide. And similarly with monosaccharides, if you string just a few of them together, you don't really have a polysaccharide, you have an oligosaccharide. So oligo means more than one, but not really all that many. And so oligodendrocyte comes from the fact that this single cell branches in such a way, tree-like branches, that it covers it covers parts of the axons of multiple different neurons, but not many. All right? So keep that in mind because there's a similar one coming up. Well, actually right now. Slide 7. Now we're in the peripheral nervous system. These are still neuroglia, but these are neuroglia of the peripheral system. And these blue ones, each of which is an individual cell, so it takes many individual cells to cover one axon. These are called Schwann cells. Yeah. Now, Schwann cell, you see a lot of this in biology. Parts of the body are named after people who are now dead. And it's not really useful because it doesn't tell you a damn thing about what it is, right? It's just someone's name. So Schwann cells, you can call them, but they also go by a more descriptive name, which is neurolemmocyte. And that neurolemma cell, in other words, the neurolemma is the covering of a neuron. That's why they're called that. They form those coverings. But what these coverings are, all these blue things, are also myelin sheaths. So the Schwann cells or the neurolemmocytes do exactly the same thing that the oligodendrocytes do in the central nervous system, only the Schwann cells are doing this in the peripheral nervous system. That's one difference. The other difference is that whereas the oligodendrocytes are called oligo because they cover multiple axons, the Schwann cell is around just part of one axon only. So this one is really like a toilet paper roll because that single cell, if you were to fold it out, would be a very long strip. And then it just wraps several times around just this little piece of the axon. Now, if you have myelinated axons, whether it's peripheral or central nervous system, there have to be little spaces between the myelin sheaths. In other words, it wouldn't work if you covered completely the axon. Then there wouldn't be any propagation of action potentials and you'd be dead. What the myelination allows to happen is for an action potential at one little gap to cause an action potential at the next gap rather than at the next tiny little slice. So you don't have to have one here, 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 here. You just go from here all the way to here. And that's what makes it a hell of a lot quicker. But if you didn't have those openings, it wouldn't happen. We'll talk more about those openings in a second. But While we're still on this slide, there's still one more neuroglial cell that we haven't talked about, and this one's also only in the peripheral nervous system. It's called satellite cells, the purplish one, which is the one that last I checked, we know the least about what they actually do. But anatomically, they cover not the axons, which are the long parts of the neuron, but the cell body, which is the big part where the nucleus is. Okay. Now in 8, we have a myelinated axon to look at. We know it's myelinated because we see several different myelin sheaths. This one's a peripheral neuron because these are Schwann cells doing this, not oligodendrocytes. But we can see these gaps I was talking about, and those gaps is another, that's another example of something named after a dead man. These are called nodes of Ranvier. So you have Schwann cells, and then between the Schwann cells, you have nodes of Ranvier. Those are the little gaps that are necessary. And so in this kind of axon, it's very fast because an action potential here will be create an action potential here without going all the way through this, and then here and here and here, and that's a lot faster. It's action potentials in general are kind of like dominoes falling. You know, you topple that first one, and it's going to topple the second one, and so on down the line. Well, if you didn't have myelin sheaths, it would be like spacing a lot of dominoes very close together, and therefore it would require a lot of action potentials to get from the beginning to the end. If you space them out more, it will require fewer dominoes, right? But notice you can't space them indefinitely. Get them too far, the first one will fall and it won't touch the second one. That's why you can't have these as big as you want. They've evolved by natural selection to be about as far apart the nodes as they can be and still work, which also makes them as fast as they can be. All right, that's 8. Let's go on to 9. Now we're looking on the right side, this brown stuff, at just one little cross-section, a plug-like piece of the spinal cord. So the vertebra has been removed. It would be normally around this. We're looking at what's inside the vertebra, the vertebral column, at the spinal cord itself. And by the way, notice that there is white matter and gray matter, myelinated and unmyelinated material that you see in that cross-section. But connected to that, the spinal cord itself, of course, is part of the central nervous system. The yellow things that are connecting to it are nerves that are part of the peripheral nervous system. And this gives you a good view of what I said earlier. A nerve is not a cell. A nerve is like a cable, a bundle of many cells. Each individual cell is a neuron. And so notice that this big bundle has two parts to it. Each one is a bundle in itself, but a smaller bundle connecting at the posterior part of the spinal cord and a smaller bundle connecting to the anterior part of the spinal cord. Each of these smaller bundles is like a one-way street in terms of the flow of information, because this bundle that connects in the rear, posterior part, is a bundle of only sensory neurons. And so they're carrying afferent information, incoming information, to deliver to the spinal cord, to deliver to the central nervous system, right? So that's only information this way. It's a one-way street. There's many lanes because each neuron is like its own lane, but they're carrying information the same way. So that means no matter where you get touched, for instance, you can touch yourself in the front, that information is going to be delivered to the central nervous system via the back of the spinal cord, going through this highway. And conversely, this other small bundle is a one-way street in the other direction. This is a bundle of only motor neurons that carry information via their axons away from the central nervous system toward an effector organ, a muscle or a gland. And so, even if it's a muscle that's in the front of your body that you're trying to move, that information is still coming out of the central nervous system. Oh, I'm sorry. Even if it's something in the back of your body that you're trying to move, that information is coming out of the front of the spinal cord, and it will reach it eventually. Okay, so these are one way. But notice then they come together to form a bigger bundle, the main part of the spinal nerve, and that's a two-way street. But importantly, that two-way street still has lanes that you're only allowed to use in one direction ever, right? Similarly, neurons don't change the direction of their information. A neuron is only sensory or only motor for any given neuron. They don't change what they do. And therefore, they don't change the direction in which they transmit information. Sensory neurons are always sending information toward the central nervous system. Motor is always sending it away. Now let's talk about various sensory receptors that are located in the skin. Now, not all sensory receptors are located in the skin, but by far most of them are. There's far fewer sensory receptors deeper in the body. Why does that make sense? Why have them in the skin?
Because that's the closest to the environment.
Right, that's where the stuff is happening around you, and therefore it's easiest to detect changes right there at the surface. The simplest of all possible sensory receptors are simply free nerve endings. They don't have a specialized organ that they're connected to. It's just the end of the neuron. And if those ends get damaged or squeezed or somehow, or if they get too hot, then that information that gets sent through them to the brain is going to end up after integration with the sensation of pain. And your brain is going to make it feel like that pain is wherever the trauma is actually occurring, but like I said, that's actually happening in your brain. So this person really must not be a very good cook, because that's a hell of an injury. It's almost all the way through the finger. In 11, we have Meissner's corpuscles. Meissner's corpuscles are not only located in the skin, but remember how the skin is arranged. You have epidermis and then dermis deep to that, right? Well, the sensory receptors in general that we're talking about are in the dermis, but the Meissner's corpuscles are in the most superficial part of the dermis, right deep to the epidermis. They're not in the epidermis, because the epidermis is it's entirely epidermal cells. But they're as superficial as they can be in the dermis. So they're as close to the surface as possible. And therefore, they really respond to not very much pressure at all, which is why you can feel the individual bristles of this paintbrush, like in this example. It doesn't take much, it doesn't push on your skin very much. It doesn't have to, though, because those receptors are so shallow. There are much deeper ones, though, like in slide 12, called lamellar corpuscles. Now, lamellar is the adjective of lamella, which is just another word for layer. So lamellar corpuscles are named for the fact that when you look at the actual makeup of the specialized receptor at the end of the neuron, it is in layers, kind of like an onion is in layers. But the reason that these respond only to much greater pressure is that they are located much deeper in the dermis. So you have to push harder on the skin for them to actually even be deformed at all. These things operate on the basis of being deformed. If they're squeezed or pulled, they will cause the neuron to create an action potential, and that ends up in the information being sent to the brain. Number 13, Golgi tendon organ. Another one named after a dead dude. The Golgi tendon organ, as the meaningful part of the word or the phrase implies, is located in a tendon, which you already know is dense, regular connective tissue that comes between a muscle and the bone that it connects to, right? And you can see that in cartoon form here. The blue stuff is collectively the Golgi tendon organ. So it doesn't make up the entire tendon, but it's embedded in the tendon. And tendons, since they are so dense, they have so many fibers, that is, do not stretch very well. They're not supposed to, right? Just like a good rope does not really stretch. It resists being stretched. That's what makes it useful. If you wouldn't want tendons to be really stretchy, because then when your muscle contracts, it would just pull on the tendon, making it longer, and you wouldn't, and there would at least be a lag in time before your bone finally moves, right? You don't want that to happen. You want the tendons not to pull, so that when the muscle contracts, the bone will quickly move. But there is a limit to how much they can, what force they can withstand. You know, if you pull with enough force on a rope, it will stretch, right? And eventually it will break. Before it breaks, it will stretch a little bit. And that's what the Golgi tendon organs are there to hopefully prevent. Because if you're pulling with enough force on your muscle to actually start stretching the tendon, then that will fire the Golgi tendon organ, and that will cause a sensation in your brain that will make you want to quickly stop doing that. Now, if it's something else, some outside force that's causing that, like a helmet on the side of the knee or something, then there's nothing you can do about it. It happens too quickly that it won't protect you. But you have the ability to use your muscles so much, especially if you have large muscles, to actually break tendons. And the pain involved because of these Golgi tendon organs will hopefully not allow you to do that. Oh, by the way, this is also a proprioceptor. It's not just about pain. Proprioception, as it's called, is a type of sensory, it's a type of sensory input. But proprioception is specifically sensory input about the positioning of organs. So the brain, of the many, many things that it's continuously keeping track of, it's keeping track of the positions of all your body parts at any given moment. You know, for instance, I know that I'm doing this behind my back, but I don't even have to be thinking about it. You can be deep in thought and be unaware of where your body parts are at the moment, but your brain knows all the time because it's also getting information from these tendon organs about what muscles are pulling on what and where the positions are. That's proprioception. Fourteen is somewhat related. This is a muscle spindle, though, also involved in proprioception. But the big difference is that these things are not embedded in the tendon, which doesn't stretch very much. These are embedded in the muscle itself, which does stretch, right? Now remember, muscles don't stretch on their own. They have to be stretched by something else, which could be the action of another muscle stretching on them. But all muscles do on their own is contract. When a muscle does get stretched, though, and therefore this muscle spindle stretches and therefore causes an action potential to be sent to the brain, the reflexive, automatic response is to send motor information to that same muscle and cause it to contract to undo that stretching. So this is why, for instance, if you're hit by the little hammer by a physician on a checkup, it causes you to kick, because that stretches a muscle spindle, and that sends a message back to that muscle to contract it, which causes you to extend your knee. Okay, those are the sensory receptors. Now we're into the molecular details again on slide 15. We've already talked about action potentials quite a bit, but I have a little bit more to say about them, because when you think about all that stuff we talked about that happens between the time of you actually deciding to move a muscle and the muscle actually contracting, right? That the stuff we talked about last time. Well, that all started out with what? What was the first step of that? Right, you deciding to move a muscle, and at the cellular level, what's the first thing? Right, and creating an action potential, not in the muscle though, right? The first thing is creating an action potential in the neuron. And so now that we're in the nervous system, let's look a little bit closer at that action potential in the neuron. Even before we get to the action potential, though, let me just say that all cells, and not just excitable cells, which neurons are, all cells of the body have what's called a resting membrane potential. Now, potential is another word for what in this sense? What do we call potentials? Voltages, right. And voltages are examples of gradients, remember. But what is a gradient? Since we're using these words, general word that means what?
A difference,
exactly. So when you're talking about a gradient, you have to be talking about two different places where you're making that same measurement. The values can differ at point A and point B, right? Like a pressure gradient or a concentration gradient. Well, here we're talking for a voltage. What we're talking about is a charge gradient, electrical charge. So the charge at place A will differ from the charge at point B. I mean, if that happens, then you have, by definition, a voltage or a potential. And that's why when you measure voltages with a multimeter, like that you can test electronic equipment with, you have to have two electrodes, right? Because you have to put it somewhere and somewhere else and see if there's a difference in charge between those two places. Well, it's not just two random places when we're talking about these potentials in the nervous system. It's specific places just outside of the cell membrane, the plasma membrane, and just inside the plasma membrane. That's where you would put the electrodes. And I'm not just saying that by analogy. You can actually there are microscopic electrodes that you can do this with, just like with a multimeter, and get a voltage. And so this is true for neurons and for muscle cells, but actually all your other living cells have a voltage as well. And now they have a voltage by definition because there's a charge difference, as I'm saying. And specifically, it is more positive outside and more negative inside. That's why it's a voltage. But why do we have these charge differences? What causes, what's responsible for the charges, first of all? What's carrying the charges?
Ions.
And the reason that there are differences in charge outside the membrane and inside the membrane is that you continuously have pumps running. We talked about pumps a little bit, right, already. I said that 40% of the reason that you eat, 40% of your food budget goes into operating the sodium-potassium exchange pumps continuously throughout your life. Well, they pump sodium ions out of the cell and potassium ions into the cell continuously. And since those are carrying charge, because they're ions, that means there's an unequal distribution of charges, and it's more positive outside and more negative inside. That's the resting membrane voltage, or potential. And that's important for all cells to have for various reasons that we won't get into. But that's not an action potential. That's a resting membrane potential, resting meaning before the action potential occurs. It has this voltage to begin with. The action potential is itself a voltage, that's why it's called an action potential, but it's a drastic change in voltage compared to what it was at rest. All right, so this is before the action potential. The situation is that the outside, just outside, not far away from the cell, but just outside the membrane is positive, just inside it's negative. So what then happens is shown in slide 16. When you have an intention to move a muscle, what you're doing is creating an action potential, and this is what is happening to create that action potential. Sodium ions are allowed into the cell from outside. Now, sodium ions can't normally get right through the membrane. Why is that? It's because they are charged, and charged things don't like to go right through the membrane. Okay? So they want to come in because there's a gradient, but they're blocked normally. In order for them to get in, they have to go through a specialized protein acting as an ion channel for sodium. So those channels are just normally closed at rest. When you fire a neuron by having this intention to move, what you're doing is opening up sodium ion channels. So now they're open, and now the sodium can come into the cell. But since each sodium is carrying positive charge, when they come into the cell, that's making the interior less negative and more positive. That's a change in voltage now. You see that? And that change in voltage is what creates the first action potential. Now that's happening only on this tiny little slice of this long cell. But when an action potential is created here, that change in voltage is going to open up channels next door and cause an action potential here. And then that one's going to cause an action potential here and so on. Exactly like dominoes falling. It's a chain reaction. And I think the next slide shows you that a little bit more clearly. The brown region is where the action potential is occurring right now, only here. This is still at resting membrane potential, but this next slice is now going to be activated into its own action potentials because sodium is going to flow through those channels that now open and so on down the line. That is what we call, well, this is just the generation of a single action potential. The chain reaction, meaning one causing the next one, that's called propagation. And so sometimes we say an action potential travels down the length of an axon. That's actually not true. What you have is one action potential causing another one right beside it and so on. The dominoes analogy is good for this as well, because you can make it as long as you want. You know, 10 kilometers long, a hell of a lot of dominoes, but you could make it that long if you wanted. No domino travels that distance, right? You just topple the first domino and it causes the next one to topple. But that information, that signal, eventually gets all the way down to the line. That is propagation. Another thing that's good about the analogy is that, unlike for electricity, which would, you know, the longer you make the wire, the weaker the electricity, the voltage gets as you go. That's not true for a neuron. Each action potential is as equally strong as the one beside it. So that no matter how long the axon is, that information will be undiminished. It will not reduced in size at all until it gets all the way to the end. Just like the dominoes, right? If you make it 10 kilometers long, you only have to just tap that first one, and it's going to equally tap all the ones all the way down the line. In 19, we see the recovery, in a sense, from the action potential. The action potential is a drastic change in the voltage. It needs to recover and get back to that resting membrane potential, which it does right after the action potential by causing these same pumps that have been working all the time to establish the situation of resting membrane potential that it started with. And so it'll go back to being slightly positive outside, slightly negative inside. Now this brown part is undergoing its own action potential, so it will recover a little bit later. And that's why you have propagation all the way down and then recovery. Now after recovery, it can undergo an action potential again. For instance, if you're trying to hang on because otherwise you would fall off a building, you need to keep contracting that muscle or you're going to fall, right? So you keep firing the neuron. You form another action potential as soon as it recovers, and then recover it again, and then send another one so that the muscle is continuously receiving new stimuli to keep contracting. And then 20, which will be the last one I talk about, this just shows you the pumps. That's no new information. I just told you that the pumps reestablish the unequal distribution of ions, and that's what actually causes the resting membrane potential. It'll be slightly positive outside, slightly negative inside. All right, let's stop there.